100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven Optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven Optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full-price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here, then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined again by James Yates. James is an archery nerd, mule deer fanatic, and hunting editor for Western Hunter magazine. This is part two of our discussion as we discuss James's macro and micro techniques for finding the biggest buck on the mountain, setting goals, hunting the hunt you want, and much more. On this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have a story coming from John Michael Tussle out of Pennsylvania. The 2019 season was my first in the mountains of central Pennsylvania. During the rifle season, my buddy Austin and I decided to go explore a piece of state forest. We headed out blind after we finished our college finals for the day. We map scouted a few promising looking areas and headed out to still hunt and try to learn something about the area. We were quickly greeted by steep ridges choked with laurel and rendered several of the spots almost useless. As the afternoon wore on, we found a draw that was a little more open coming out of a saddle off the ridge we were on. There were a few oaks in the opening that had a good bit of sign on the ground around them with rubs all around. With an hour of light left and nothing to lose, we set up with the wind in our face against a big tree facing up the draw. With 5 minutes of light left, a small buck worked across the ridge into the opening to feed. I scoped him, and to my surprise, I could see another rack coming out of the laurel behind him. I immediately told Austin to get ready. A shooter was going to come out. Thank goodness the wind had picked up, or I'm sure he would have heard our franticness as he stepped out at 50 yards. With only a minute of left light, I offered to let Austin shoot him as he began to feed. But as soon as he told me he was having trouble seeing through his scope, I let my rifle shatter the silence and the buck folded down. The way we screamed and yelled and high-fived, it may as well have been a 200-inch buck. It ended up being a dark antlered heavy 8-point in my first Central PA mountain buck. Well, congratulations to John Michael. This is an awesome deer, heavy dark antlered mountain buck from Pennsylvania. And actually, I'll have quite a few more stories to share here from John Michaels. He's ended up killing a buck, a mountain buck, every year since then, and he shared stories from all of them. So I'll be sharing those through the coming weeks and months here. So thank you for submitting it. And if you want to submit your story, send it in to my email, beau@eastmeetswesthunt.com. And then you can see the posts over on East Meets West Hunt on Instagram or East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook. In other news, I'll go through this kind of quickly here so we can get into this episode, but thanks for everyone that's watched the two-part film series, Riding Mountain Waves, the elk hunt that I had in Montana last year, getting some great feedback on the film, and I appreciate everyone that has been, you know, I guess forthcoming with sharing their appreciation of just being open and honest and showing how the hunt went, even though some of it's not always as pretty as we'd like for it to be. So thank you for that. If you haven't watched it yet, it's on my YouTube channel, Beau Martonic. You can go check that out, as well as all of the podcast clips are on my YouTube channel now. I've been doing that for a little while now. So every episode I break down roughly 5 to 12 minute clips from the episode on certain topics, add some graphics and stuff to it to help explain the story that the guest is talking about in there. So if you want just something quick to be able to watch in a short period of time, check those out, and they're all full video format there. So I appreciate it. And if you like the YouTube channel, please give that a subscribe. And other news, I just got back from Alabama. I was in Fayette, Alabama for a few days doing a long range hunting course by Guardian Precision. So these guys, I've known them for a while. A couple of Navy SEAL snipers previously, and with over 40 years of experience in the SEAL teams that know rifles really well, and they're also hunters. So it's pretty cool to get to learn from that. They're friends of mine, and they are going to be doing a course eventually that's open to the public, anybody that wants to sign up, and do that in very small groups so that you get some one-on-one time and learning how to do rifle setups and all the different basics of shooting on a flat range, shooting in real life scenarios, using tree branches in your pack and all these things, and be able to be efficient stretching out your range at some longer distances. It was so beneficial, and we'll have a full podcast coming in the future on that I did while I was out there with Drew from Seek One. We had Josh from the Untamed there, my brother Kurt the gunsmith, had everybody, there going through the course and learning some stuff. So it was super helpful. But for now, they do have an Instagram page, Guardian Precision. You can check that out and follow along for updates on more information on when those courses are going to go live, and maybe you'll be able to attend one. In other news, I guess the last thing I want to say is I mentioned it on some previous episodes here, but I want to start doing some Q&A episodes specifically around whitetails, mountain bucks, whatever. Submit your questions that you have, and there'll be some short, like, you know, 10 to 15 minute episodes that I'll roll out, you know, in addition to the regular weekly podcast. So you can send those to my email, bo@eastmeetswesthunt.com, or just leave a comment on a YouTube video. And I'll make sure I keep those into account and try to answer a couple questions on one of those episodes and dive into some of those specific topics that you're looking for. But with that being said, I hope everyone has a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you soon. Kind of shifting gears a little bit here. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the way that you hunt mule deer, which I think is super interesting. And you seem to find specific deer, at least from the outside looking in, you find specific deer and you try to hunt them and go after these deer. And when I was talking to you at Total Archery Challenge, just like some of the things that you were talking about, and I've heard you on other podcasts and stuff like talk, and I was like, there's such a correlation to the way that I hunt whitetails, even though, I mean, a little bit different approach, but the same kind of style and work that you put into that is incredible. And I don't know if it would be best to kind of just have, like, you talk about kind of your approach is the way you look at it, or from a, you know, a story of a specific buck. I'll kind of leave that up to you to think how you would describe kind of your approach there.
Yeah. So I do, specifically on mule deer, and mostly for whatever reason, the units that I tend to be really picky here in Utah. I tend to be picky on my Arizona hunt. And those are the two that I'm actually pretty picky. For one, both those places have potential to produce really big deer. It's extremely difficult. So I'm talking OTC, right? Because I'm the world's worst person at drawing tags. I've literally only ever drawn one control tag, and I spent 7 points on a 3-point unit. So everything else that I do is OTC or general. No points, that sort of thing. So my deer hunt, I do every year. You know, the unit has a crazy amount of pressure here in Utah. I just deal with it. I figured out different tactics that work for me, and that's the hunt that I do. It's in my backyard. I can spend an ultra amount of time. And then the same in Arizona. It's fairly close. And if you're willing to put in the work and you learn some things, there's some big buck potential down there on the OTC tags. But that, again, that's not for the faint of heart. There's more area to spread out, so you don't feel the pressure near as much as the front, but I mean, you got to glass 30 square miles to turn up 6 deer in some of those deep desert areas. So it's just unique and a challenging. So first of all, you have to kind of, for me, I have to identify a unit. Am I going to be ultra picky in a unit that I know isn't going to produce, let's just call it 190 inch, 200 inch type deer? Well, no, because you got, for one, the unit has to be able to produce that type of deer, right? So if you're trying to hold out for a certain size buck in a unit that's not capable or very remotely capable, low percent chance of producing a buck like that, you're kicking yourself. So you kind of have to have a rolling standard versus the compared to the hunts that you do. So and that's my approach. So here on the front, I am ultra, ultra picky. It's in my backyard. I've got essentially 3.5 months to hunt. Plus on top of that, I've got 2 months during the summer to scout three or four days a week. So I've got the time to put into it. I've got a job that allows me to be away in the mornings. I've got a very understanding wife that understands my fixation on hunting, and it makes me a better father, husband. She knows that a happier, you hear happier, happy wife, happy life or whatever. It's, well, happy husband, happy in her mind, right? So I do spend a ton of, we're going backpack. We're taking our 7-year-old and our 4-year-old backpacking this weekend. So I do a ton of family stuff too. So I don't want to sound like I just,
you're not just a shitbag father. But, I got it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, sometimes during hunting season, I feel that way. When I was chasing a buck that I killed, pretty good buck I killed, a few years ago, I call KK, it was a late November hunt. And, anyway, I spent probably too much time obsessing and hunting that deer and probably strained the family life a little bit, but it was very, very specific deer. And, I think my wife was very understanding. I spend an ungodly amount of time hunting that deer. So, anyway, but, so my tactic is you go out there, you scout up. I don't have the opportunity to scout in Arizona, but, so you go out there and you find a buck or a couple of bucks that are really intriguing to you. The type of bucks that are going to allow you to, despite all of the crap, the pressure, the fatigue, you know, getting 4 hours of sleep. Like I was joking with my buddies that this week, Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night, because I glassed Monday morning, Tuesday morning, and Wednesday morning. So the 3 nights previous, I got 4 hours of sleep. Three nights back to back, 4 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep. You've got to find a deer that motivates you enough to want to do that, right? So it's like this obsessive thing. So this is just me, and this is just how I work. If I can find that quality of deer, it's something that I'm willing to sink my time into. So that's a really important thing. And it varies for me, right? Like the particular deer called KK, he was just a really big deer, but then there's been other deer that have intrigued me because they're really old or they're very unique. Or honestly, this year, if I find a really, really big typical 4-point, like 180, I'd be pretty hard to pass up a perfectly symmetrical 180-inch 4-point. I've killed several deer that score better than 180 inches. So a lot of people ask, well, why wouldn't you hold out for anything better? Well, because I don't have a perfect 180 plus inch 4-point on my wall, and it's a gap I want to fill. So it's kind of, you got to find something that you're willing to obsess over. That's the most important part to this sort of hunting. Then just day in and day out, you're going to go hunt that deer. You don't give up hunting that deer. You don't think, well, maybe this other, until you know that deer has either been killed or maybe is for sure gone. Maybe you've gone 2 weeks and you haven't seen the deer. Then, maybe you're going to change something. But so you're ultra obsessive. You find him scouting, and then you spend every waking moment on the mountain hunting that deer. In my particular case, I've got to use alternate methods because for the most part, where I found those big deer, you can't spot and stalk them. So I utilize ambush hunting. I've hunted bucks out of tree stands, ambush, pinch points, light bumps, light wind bumps. You and I talked about that a little bit. And so a lot of that comes in. So here on the front, I scout. I have two terms. I say macro, I macro scout. So I take big optics, BTX 115, ATX 115, and I've got these strategic glassing points where I can see into multiple basins. And then I identify frames and then I move in and get a closer look. I've been doing that for 10 years. So I'm not the guy that's got the cleanest, best phone scope of every deer, right? Because I'm glassing them from 3 miles away. But I know with just how busy I am, I can't go micro glass every individual basin, right? I've got to figure things. I've got to I just got to figure it out because I can't be on the mountain every day. So once I find that deer, I go and make sure that's the one, and then I'm focused on it. I know his route. So what I try to optimize is the number of opportunities. And when I say opportunities, then for me on the Wasatch Front, I found that it's just a morning gig. The evenings kind of suck. So I want to optimize the number of mornings that I'm in position on that deer. So that's where with my job on the front, being able to be up there the most mornings that I can is very effective. So it's very much like this. You figure out where they're living. You kind of figure out his pattern. But here on the front also, there's so much pressure that after the opening weekend, their pattern kind of shifts because of all the pressure. So, but you're still putting yourself in that position. You're still up there. And you know, having a buddy that can come up and help glass for you once you find him, or come lightly bump him, that stuff speaks volumes. But it's this war of attrition for me on these deer that I've killed, because again, I can't very rarely will I spot a deer, put it to bed, and stalk him. For one, that literally just doesn't happen very much because of our terrain and our thickness, and then also because of the hunting pressure. Similar to Arizona, where I can't quite do this war of attrition in Arizona. I start out on the biggest, gnarliest peak, and I pull out the big glass, and I'm looking for, and this is a rut hunt, right? So I'm just looking for deer, and then, oh, there's a bunch of deer over there. Then I'll kind of point hop over to that better spot. And then I'll kind of hone in. So I've killed a number of pretty good deer. That one, he doesn't look giant from below, but that's 170-inch 3-point. and it's a desert deer. That's a big 3-point. That's my second favorite buck because of just the amount of time. And I've killed four or five bucks to score better than him. But that deer just, it was Arizona, out of state. We were grinding for the first 6 days of the hunt, and then we found him, and then we focused. And to the much gratitude to my friend, he let me continue to stalk this deer, even though we were swapping days on stalks. And anyway, so after 3 or 4 days of hunting that deer, fun, they got him killed. But it was the same thing, like macro glassing, finally found him, turned micro, and then just war of attrition, just trying to be in this particular case. And I find it happen a lot on the rut. Once deer kind of group up in the rut, they start behaving more like elk. That lead doe will feed with her nose into the wind. Kind of more on rutting grounds, right? It's not so much big mountain country. There, it's more just thermals, but rut-type hunts, they'll behave like elk. They'll feed into the wind. So it's really hard. It can be really hard to stalk in on a bedded buck because he's probably surrounded by does. And think about this. So if you're stalking in on a group of deer and you're waiting for them to stand up, right? Maybe you can't get a shot in his bed. You're coming at it basically, if they're facing into the wind, so you're coming at his butt, right? Well, if they get up to move and they're going to feed into the wind, they're going to get up and feed straight away from you. You know how many times I've heard that I was in position 40 yards from the deer, but he stood up and just fed straight away. Well, he's feeding into the wind with the deer, right? So, you're better off if you can't shoot the buck in his bed, you're better off to get 90 degrees to him and wait for him there because the group's going to feed into the wind. And then you do it just like it's classic elk hunting, not calling type situation. You kind of dog that herd until he's on the periphery, and then you got to be close enough that you can take advantage of that opportunity. And that's how I killed this deer after 4 days of doing it. So it's just this war of attrition that sooner or later they're going to make a mistake, but you need to be in position for that lucky opportunity to happen. So that for the most part, that's why I've killed all of my really good animals, with the exception of one. I've got like 190-inch, a whitetail frame 3x4. I killed the second day of the hunt. We did a little bump, and he pushed on an escape route that I had seen him on. In fact, it was the same trail that I glassed him up on that morning. I was in position, made a really good shot, and shout out to my good friend Ty Glenn. He helped me kill that deer, as he has helped me kill several deer. And anyway, but yeah, the war of attrition. So does that kind of
it's good. And I like how you explain the macro and the micro, because like I can relate that, again, going back to whitetail, just because that's what I'm familiar with. But like, so for us here, you know, in the east in the Appalachian Mountains, you can't really glass or be able to see. So I'll do a lot of times with cameras. Like I'll go to these different areas that look good from a map, have the vegetation diversity and cover I'm looking for, and I'll start throwing cameras in these different spots, you know, maybe just a few out. And then once I collect that data, it's like, okay, here's a buck worth going after or something I want to go. And now I'm going to start putting more cameras in there and maybe start, you know, looking and trying to identify tracks in different spots and trying to really start honing in on those spots versus, you know, just either going all in on one spot, you know, from the beginning, or just like kind of starting broad and then narrowing it down as it goes.
Yep. And narrow down. That's my scouting approach. And even if I'm in a unit that I'm not scouting, that's my hunting approach. So that's Arizona, right? Like I go down there with very limited time. So Brody's the customer service manager for Western Hunter. I love Brody. He's a great guy. He picked me up from the airport in our Arizona hunt this year. We had 5 days. And in 5 days, so I killed that buck in 2022. Okay. So 2023, so a few months ago, so January of this year, went down there for 5 days. Same thing. Started out glassing like 30 square miles from one giant peak, and then kind of just hopped and honed in on our spot. And we hunted, and I stalked and almost killed, was within 100 yards. A different buck had come through and kind of busted up the herd, and they escaped out of the saddle before I get a shot. But I hunted 193-inch 4-point. He was killed by a local whose dad actually had sent an arrow through no man's land on the buck, and the buck survived. Anyway, come January, the son was able to start hunting. And while I was there, I didn't know it, but we continued to hunt that buck for 3 more days. And the last day he was already dead, but I didn't find out to the end of the hunt. But kind of the same thing. You just start out really macro, and then identify what you're going to do. And then, so a lot of times that's really important, right? So you can, Arizona, you can actually do some spot and stalking, from a terrain perspective. Cause you may lose them for a second, but for the most part, you don't lose them completely like our forest here. So you can stalk in on a deer that's bedded. The problem with that is oftentimes they're surrounded by does, and so you can't get in. And in that situation, if you can't shoot him in his bed, I kind of like to get that 90 degrees to him. Maybe just into the wind a little bit, 90 degrees, so that you can be in a better position when he stands up, and then feeds towards you, right? Not feeds towards you, but feeds, you know, you're kind of doing, he's going this way and you're doing this way.
Yeah. Kind of an angle trying to run into him essentially. Yeah. And, you know, and it's like, I like the other part you said about, you know, just the persistence aspect of it. Like, you know, when last year, I was hunting elk in Montana and I found this big bull, and I'm not someone that was chasing. Well, I was trying to shoot a good bull, because I'd shot, you know, a raghorn essentially, my first bull, and I was like, all right, I want to shoot a bigger bull, and then I found this herd bull that was just like incredible, and I dedicated my hunt to going after him, and it took 14 days before I had my opportunity, and it was exactly what you said, where it was like, I was doing the same thing every day, and I just was waiting for him to do something stupid and me get lucky, as far as, you know, pushing the cow, squirted out of the group and, you know, came there. And, but during the hunt, I was so in my head, as far as like, I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. You know, you're there and you're like, I don't know, usually I'm just trying to find elk. And at this point I was like, I'd found them and I was, you know, they'd go and they'd bed and the herd bull would bed on this knob and he had cows around him. And then he had satellites on the outside. And it was like, I'd chase them up the mountain in the morning, you know, trying that tactic and doing it. Yep. And then they go bed and then I'd kind of just sit on them. And, you know, I tried a couple times getting in close and being aggressive and he didn't care. He had all the cows in the world with him. So it was like, then I'd wait for the evening and try to anticipate where he was going and play the wind and the thermals and try to get just on the side of him. And like, for me, it was, I didn't have much experience with it, but it felt like the right thing to do at that time. And I was talking to, Corey Jacobson at TAC about it. And I was like, you know, explaining, I was like, how do you, you know, do that? How do you get close to some of these bulls or like when you find them like that? He's like, sounds like you're doing the right thing. It just, it takes the time to be able to do it sometimes. Have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the ChatGPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade Short Barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
Yeah, just the there's always going to be a luck aspect, right, to hunting because it's a wild animal. But you got to put yourself in the position for luck to happen to you. And that's just the story of my life. And you go and listen to podcasts with a guy, you know, I respect the hell out of like Tony Treach. He's constantly talking about this as well. Putting your time in so that you can, so that when the right opportunity happens, you can capitalize on it. And that is just exactly how things have happened for me with, you know, my big animals. And so you got it. Like I said, you got to be somewhat obsessive. You got to find a deer or an elk that motivates you to just, despite all the shit. And I can tell you 14 days, 2 months, you know, when you're doing the same thing, you know, that's the definition of insanity, right? Is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. Well, that's how you kill big animals. You become insane because you're doing the definition of insanity, but that's how you do it. And the difference is eventually that animal is going to screw up and you got to be there to capitalize on it. I remember Brian Barney is another guy I respect. Yeah. He killed a really big bull the same year that I killed my big buck, the KK. And I remember Brian saying something, in a podcast or maybe mention something on an Instagram post that like he just day in and day out, he was just dogging it. And finally he made a mistake and he killed it. And at the time I was hunting KK and I kind of just used that as a moment. Like I just need to stick with it. And eventually, well, it turns out this particular buck, he was just nocturnal and he just stayed in the thick forest. Like it was a kind of mule deer, behaved very, very uncharacteristically for mule deer. Anyway, I ended up having to wait till the rut before he even like came out into the daylight, if you will. He was like, maybe he identified as a albino deer and he just didn't want to be in the sun from health.
Yeah.
I don't know. But that deer just did not like the sun and just stayed in the forest until the rut, until he was booty blinded by the does. But anyway, you got to be motivated on the animal. So if you're going to pick something like this, if you're going to trophy hunt or selective hunt, you got to find something that you're motivated on, because I can tell you what, you're going to break down and you got to be okay with eating tag soup. That's something that bugged the crap out of me a long time ago and doesn't bug me anymore. I mean, repetitive tag soup starts to bug me, but like the Wasatch Front tag soup, where I know I'm just pursuing the biggest buck I can find all summer, that tag soup doesn't bug me. Now, tag soup all season long, yeah, that starts to bug me. Like, not every hunt that I do is oriented to that trophy style hunting, right? Like, I know that I'm gonna bow hunt 50 days on the front this year, and I know I'm going to be just dead exhausted by the end of the hunt. So when I kind of do my out of state hunts, I actually joked with my buddy when I killed this deer, which for a desert 3-point, 170 inches, he's a big ass trophy in my mind. I actually told my buddy, I was like, man, I really hope that we don't find a really nice, definably big mule deer, because I just kind of want to have fun on this hunt. And, you know, 4 days into the hunt, we find him and I'm like, oh, F, I got to hunt him. Because I don't think every hunt can be that way, right? There's still some fun and adventure to just buck hunting or bull hunting. So I don't get overly serious on all my hunts. Like, I'll start out being pretty serious on the front. I'll be serious the whole time on the front, but I'm going to hunt muzzleloader Colorado. Not going to be too picky there. I've got an Idaho tag. And the funny thing is everybody in the industry just thinks that bow hunting is the hardest and bow, you know, bow only, bow, yada, yada, yada. You want to hunt the hunts that kick my butt more than any hunt is general season Utah and Idaho rifle hunts. I can for the life of me not kill a nice 175 inch plus buck on either of those hunts. Now, I haven't hunted general season Utah rifle forever, but I try to get up to Idaho as frequently as I can for their general rifle hunt, and that's a hard hunt. So everyone that thinks that bow hunting is so hard and rifle hunting kicks my ass. Like, I can bow hunt in August and September and November, and you're seeing these big deer and you can be motivated. Well, if you're, you know, I've killed a lot of deer, and I'm fine with eating tag soup. And I'm not saying that every deer needs to be 190 inches, but if I want to go kill 175 inch deer in Idaho, I'm going to set my sights on that and probably stick with it. 175 inches, I think, is accomplishable in the units that I want to hunt. But holy hell, it can be hard to find that deer on that hunt. And so a lot of me, like, as much as I love bow hunting and I just eat, drink, and breathe shooting my bow and tuning my bow and fiddling with it, I love open sight muzzleloader hunting and I love rifle hunting. And I kind of just, not necessarily that we fight or quabble amongst ourselves, but like, there's a lot of aspects of rifle hunting that are harder than bow hunting and aspects of bow hunting that are harder than rifle hunting. And, you know, it's just, I don't even know why I'm on this, but I think it's important to realize that we're all hunters. We all deal with issues. My biggest thing, like, I don't really care the weapon that you kill it with. This is personal, but what I personally want to know when somebody kills something, I know that a lot of people will, oh, he killed that with a rifle, I'm going to discount that completely in my mind. That's not how I roll. I want to know if he killed it on public land and if he killed it on kind of like a high-end tag there's just such a disparity between the general season type stuff and the limited entry type stuff. Two things I want to know when somebody kills something is, was it public land and what type of tag was it? Not, what weapon was it? What, not to say that I have a problem with guys buying tags or anything like that. It's just, if you want to get an idea of what you can set your sights on, right? Because if everyone's hunting general season, you can't go and set your sights on somebody who's hunting the Alton Ranch every year, right? Like, that's not realistic. So it's not like a comparison thing. It's just, well, I guess it is a comparison thing, but it's not like a competing with a person. It's just, what is realistic attainable goals?
Yeah, right? Realistic attainable for what you're hunting and what you're doing. You know, that's right. You know, I think you and I talked about it a little bit when we were at TAC, but like, that's what I said, like, I love hunting Pennsylvania so much for whitetails, and everyone's like, that's crazy. You know, there's not the biggest deer in the world there or anything, but it's like, this is a place that I can scout. I can do my work, go all in. And, you know, if I shoot 130-inch whitetail that's 6 years old, like, that's awesome. That's, you know, that's incredible. And, you know, I would compare it to shooting, you know, a bigger buck in a state that has more of them. And I'm not discounting that state. It's just like, I just look at every place I go and every experience a little bit different, you know, and what I want out of it and being able to do it. And it's just, I think that's kind of fun, and everyone's got their different goals and what they want out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you said that. Cause that's the sort of thing that I'm referring to. We get obliterated with social media and we see the good side of everybody and the highlights. Kind of funny thing that you mentioned that, because it reminded me of a guy that I have mad respect for. His name's Steve Evans. He's mostly a rifle hunter. He lives in California. And last year he killed, so unless you're like on the far east side of California, you're hunting blacktail mule deer hybrids. They don't get that big. He killed like 173-inch blacktail mule deer hybrid last year on the opening day of their rifle hunt. And people just got he posted something on Instagram, and it was just like, people think it's just a mule deer, and yeah, it's a good buck, right? It's a good buck, good rifle buck. Well, what the people don't know is, like, no, that is a California blacktail mule deer hybrid. And that is like the equivalent of killing a 210-inch buck in Nevada or Utah or Colorado or Wyoming. And so you can't just look at social media and be like, well, this dude always kills 200-inch deer. Well, guess what? He's hunting the best tags every single year. Not that I have a problem with that, but don't go and comparing yourself to that. Don't think that that's attainable, because it's not. Not every one of my hunts is a trophy hunt. Not every, you know, you just got to take everything with a grain of salt, and you got to figure out your niche and use social media to motivate you. Get competitive. Like, competition is what drives us as human beings. It's not a bad thing to feel like, oh shit, he did that on public land, I want to go do that. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, no. And the one way I look at it, at least, is like, you know, I'll see people that are hunting your whitetail, elk, mule deer on places that are arguably a lot better than where I'm hunting them most of the time. Okay? Yeah. And it's like, I don't discount them at all. Like, I don't look at them and it's like, oh, you know, it must be nice or do anything like that. Like, that's awesome. But I'm also not going to compare myself to them as far as what I'm able to have an opportunity at or you know, be able to do. And I think that's just like, because it can get, you know, if you're having a bad season or whatever, having a trouble on your hunt, it's so hard when, like, I remember I was elk hunting there and I got service for a little bit, and I'm like on day 9 or whatever and had missed a bull and like all this stuff. And then all of a sudden I look and it's like, everybody's killing bulls. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. No, I was happy for him, obviously, but you get that thing in your head. You're like, what the heck?
No, you can't.
Like, why do I suck so bad? One thing you said earlier that I really liked, and this is how I compare it, is like when you talked about something that motivates you enough to go it and, you know, to really go all in and, you know, go through all the ups and downs. Think about it. It's like, all right, you find that buck, that bull or whatever it is that you want to chase. Doesn't matter how big he is, but to you, if it's like, this is your thing that you want to hunt, it's like filling up a 3-liter platypus bag versus a Nalgene bottle and just dripping the motivation out through it. Cause you're just going to run through it. It's like, all right, you got more in the tank.
You gotta, Yeah, you got to figure something out, because trophy or selective hunting, whatever you want to call it, to me, it's the same thing. That's going to drain your tank. It drains my tank every year. By the time the hunt ends here on the Wasatch Front, I am so ready for it to be done. And then, you know, 4 weeks right later, I'm ready to go to Arizona, right? Because it's a different change of pace down there, and I get to go hunt with good friends down there. But by the time the hunt ends on the front, I put it all out there. I've done everything I could possibly do, and I'm so relieved when the hunt ends, because I've just put it all out there. And I think, honestly, I think that's what it takes in this particular area. Just that obsessive compulsive type, just war of attrition. I think that there's a lot to be said for just putting your head down and going to work every day, trying not to be distracted by others, using it as motivation. I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think comparison is bad. I mean, I think that it can be bad, but if it motivates you and shows you what's possible, then, I mean, score in and of itself is for comparison, right? What's the purpose of score? It's comparison. The Boone and Crockett, Pope and Young, that's all comparison. That you're comparing yourself to your peers. Before I got really, so I've rifle hunted my whole life since I was a kid, you know, very young, fished, hunt, well, teenager in my 20s, for 10, 15 years, I was a very competitive rock climber, traveled the world, that met my wife climbing. And same thing, like climbs are graded on the Yosemite decimal system, and though you're not climbing, you know, you're not competing, maybe on the Wasatch because it's Mortal Kombat hunting, you're competing against other hunters, but typically hunting isn't competing against others, but you kind of are if you're chasing a score. That's comparison. Same with climbing, the two are the same. You're not climbing unless you're speed climbing and the X Games or something. You're not climbing against somebody else, but you're climbing against a particular grade that you want to achieve, but somebody else set that grade. So you really are, it's still a competitive sport because you're trying to attain. And same with hunting, especially selective and trophy hunting. For the most part, you're not, I guess there's that show that's like Hunt Wars or something that maybe is direct competition, but anyway, you get what I'm saying. It's competitive in the fact that you're shooting for a score that's being judged on or has been developed from your peers. So competition is good. It can serve as a motivation, show you what's possible. As soon as that starts to like degrade you, which it does for every one of us, that's kind of when you gotta turn it off. And then you gotta realize that social media is the highlight reel for everyone. And I get it. Just the other day at the Easton, the guy made the comment thinking that I have like endless time. Well, no, dude, I don't have endless time. So the one thing that my friend and I joke that, so for whatever reason, I'm just really unlucky and I end up having to put a lot of effort in on my hunts. And if God could like watermark an effort meter on every, you know what I mean? I'd be interested to see that. Not that it means two shits, cause I got lucky on that 3x4 I was telling you about where I killed him second day of the hunt. Like not a ton of effort went into that hunt, but like other hunts, like it could be cool if there was like a watermark, and I would respect that, man. If I came across Instagram and I saw this watermark and some dude had like 140 inch 3-point or 4-5, I don't care, you know, some maybe average buck, but the watermark was just pegged, dude, I'd get on there and I'd comment the hell out of it. Cause that at the end of the day, like I like to see people putting themselves out there, doing better, and accomplishing goals and wading through the muck to find success. Cause that's just like, that's the American dream, yeah. Right? Like we wade through the muck and to find success. And that's why I think OTC, I don't know what I'm going to do when I finally draw like a really good limited tag. I'm probably going to like pass out or die of a heart attack because I'm not going to know what to do. Like, I'm not going to know. I'm going to have so much pressure on myself. Like, oh my word, I've drawn my first. Literally, I've applied for every Western, major Western state for 10 years, and I can't draw a limited tag to save my life. But anyway, and I would like to know, maybe you buy a ranch tag, but maybe it's a hard fucking hunt and your water meter's pegged. I don't care if it's a ranch hunt. Like if you have to freaking work your ass off to kill that animal, great.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't matter. Like I just want to see people work hard to obtain their goals. The thing that hurts me the most, especially on the front, is there's been a couple instances where a couple of bucks that I've been aware of and a couple that I've chased have been killed by guys who's like, yeah, that was my first time up hunting the front this year. And I was just like,
oh yeah,
it's like November. And I'm like, my eyes are like my, I just haven't slept 8 hours in like 4 months. And my eyes are like falling out and you killed the first day. When you say first day, you're just first day this week or is that first day. Yeah. I actually just moved here from North Carolina and this guy recommended this trail and I came up here and he was chasing a doe across the trail. This is a true story.
I figured it was.
And I'm just like, oh, it's a buck I called Forklift. And then another buck I called King Crab died by some out of state guy who actually was camped on the mountain and knew how to kill deer. So, but yeah, I mean, those are the ones that I'm just like,
well, I'm shooting a new bow this year and I am pumped. After playing around with a buddy's Hoyt RX-8, the smile on my face made the decision for me. The first thing I noticed with the new Hoyts were their extremely smooth draw cycles and the ability to adjust the back wall to make it rock solid like I prefer. I outfitted my own RX-8 with the inline accessories that made installation extremely easy and balanced out the bow. My favorite accessory so far is a simple one. It's the Go Sticks 2.0 adjustable legs to make your bow like a tripod, but it doesn't interfere with any part of the bow or the limbs or anything like that. In addition, the integrated kickstand within the HBX Exact cams protect your string from excess wear when you put your cam into the dirt. Ground hunting or spot and stalk just got easier. If you want to experience what I'm talking about, head to your nearest Hoyt dealer and take a test drive yourself. You can learn more at Hoyt.com. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
Most painful but funny meme that I've seen on Instagram is it's pushed right at Pennsylvania hunters, but it's like you've been chasing this buck all season and this guy is gonna shoot it on the first day a rifle sitting on an open power line or whatever, and it's just like it's Dwight from The Office like smoking a cigarette, like, you know, just sitting there. It's just like that's what happens. But what, you know, people are probably tired of me saying this, but it's so true. Is I talk to so many really, you know, successful hunters, you know, across the country and everywhere. And it's like everybody has, there's one thing that everybody does, and that's just grind until the absolute end. And, you know, like talking to you and, you know, reminds me of like Tony Treach, who's become a good friend of mine. And Tony's going to be pumped that, you know, I'm doing some more Western hunting podcasts. He was just bitching at me the other day saying that I was doing too much whitetail stuff. But he, you know, I remember, and I was personally kind of invested in this one because I was, you know, texting him and I was hunting the same area before and he was coming in and he's like, I'm going to find this elk that I found last year and I'm going to hunt him. And he spent days and days and he found him. And he's like, I'm just like, you know, I had no idea if he was even still alive, but he was focused on finding this bull. And then like, you know, he'd text me at night and be like, oh, he wasn't in a stalkable position. You know, he was just waiting, waiting, waiting. Yep. The next thing you know, I'm getting a picture of this giant bull that, you know, shouldn't have come out of this area. Like, and I'm like, you know, that's just, and it doesn't just happen once to him, you know, and happen to guys like you, like it happens over and over again. It's like, that's the definition of some hard work and dedication that goes into it to be able to make those things happen. And man, that motivates me seeing other people do that and, you know, continually do that for me to become better. You know, like when you look, you know, even, you know, you mentioned a competition standpoint, I even look at it like I put, you know, you guys on like a pedestal of like, okay, I want to do that. Like, I want to be like that, but you can't.
Mine's a little shorter. So I don't know if I put me on a pedestal. Maybe I need to be on a taller pedestal because I'm short. So I'm still shorter than the rest, but my pedestal's taller. Anyway, you're going off a total height.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll go with that. But no, but it's so true. Like, I don't know. I use that as motivation, you know, and I look at it like I've been lucky enough to have like my dad that I've seen on the whitetail side that's been shooting nice bucks every single year since I was a kid. Like, never, it just seems like he's always doing it. And it's like, but he's still outworking me, you know, 2 to 3 times of what I'm able to do. And it's just like that motivates me to, you know, continually, you know, do better and get better at these things. So I don't know. I love it.
Yeah. I think that sometimes we want to shy away from that competition is a real thing and comparison isn't good. And it's good. It's what drives human society. You just got to keep that stuff in check. And you got to be realistic. Again, don't go comparing yourself. I won't name names, but there's plenty of guys out there who, you know, and they've worked their asses off to get to a point in their life where they can buy those great tags every year. But if you're a general season OTC type hunter, you can't set your goal on, you know, killing a, you know, it's just unrealistic to set your goal that you're going to kill a 200 incher on your, like, for example, you're going to South Dakota. I know that that's a really target rich environment. I've had a couple of buddies do that hunt and they love it, but unless something fluky happens, you're probably not going to see many bucks over 165, even one, you know, 175, 170, 165, but you're going to see a whole lot of bucks in that 130 to 150 class range. So you got to know what you're getting into. It's great training grounds. If I had the time at the end, like going to South Dakota in November and just having fun and stalking bucks, like I'm all for it. You just got to know what you're getting into. Right. And then when you draw that coveted tag, hopefully you've got some experience under your belt, stalking deer, killing deer. You can't go, in my mind, some people may disagree, you can't go from zero to hero. You can't go from zero to hero.
Totally agree.
You can't go from you've never killed anything to all of a sudden you're expecting to kill 200 inch deer around every tree, because what's going to happen when you draw back on that 200 inch buck and you realize, oh shit, I get really bad buck fever, or there's just so many things that can go. I get a big kick. My buddies and I get a big kick out of this term. Like, I passed on that buck. Well, what does that mean? Like, I've literally had opportunities where I thought that this 180 inch buck, like multiple, I'm saying like probably more than 10, like maybe not more than 10, but definitely more than 5. So between 5 and 10 opportunities on 180-inch type bucks or better, where something happened when I was inside bow range and or drawing my bow and even arrow release, and I still didn't kill him. So how in the hell are you saying that you passed on a particular animal when I've shot arrows at 185-inch deer and didn't kill them? Like, a stick that you didn't see comes out of nowhere and just says F you and blocks your arrow, or the buck's not even aware of you and he's got his head up a doe's butt and somehow doesn't react to your arrow, but decides to like take an extra step or something. So I just get a kick out of that term, like, oh yeah, I could have killed him, I passed on him. I'm like, oh, well, shit happens right up until you draw double long blood. And then, yeah, it just happens. I mean, and sometimes, I haven't talked much about it, but I hit a pretty good buck on the front, not giant, but, last year, thought he was dead to rights, got long blood, didn't find him. I spent the rest of the hunt, looking for the deer. I was looking for one deer in particular, couldn't find him. And then I told myself after Thanksgiving, this is probably something worth saying. I hunted this particular deer all season, found him scouting early on, doing the macro glassing thing, zoned in, little bit of pressure on the opener, the deer vanished and didn't find him, took a pause on that, hunted out of state, regrouped, came back in November, searched my guts out for him, couldn't find him. I told myself after Thanksgiving Day, if I have not found the deer, I'm going to go buck hunting, yep, if you will. Still with a high, still being pretty selective, but so I found this buck, decided to stalk him, almost got a shot off the first day, second day in, hit him really good, lung blood. I don't know what happened. He kicked as, so my arrow hit like right behind his shoulder. I had a guy that was, watching through the spotter. He saw it as well at the same time that like he was kicking. So I think what happened is his near side shoulder pushed the back of the arrow back, forcing the front of the arrow forward in the body cavity. So I don't know how, cause it was broadside, but I know I only got one lung.
Okay.
So something had to happen with that arrow, to force it forward. Well, it just so happens that I distinctly remember, and the guy who was spotting for me remembers as well, that you saw the impact right behind the shoulder. You saw him kicking, and then you saw my arrow break. Like he didn't brush it off on anything. And I've seen this plenty of times before, on deer and elk where, well, they'll break at when that near side blade comes back, that scapula will come back and break that arrow off. Well, that happened, I think, as my arrow was going in. And so I think he drove it first. So I know I got one lung on a broadside shot right behind the shoulder. And that's just me trying to figure out why I only got one lung on that shot situation. And I spent, so Thanksgiving, 24th last year, the hunt closed the end of November. So I spent the next 7 days looking for that buck. Never found him, looked for birds for another 2 weeks. I know he's dead because this particular area is in a spot that I can glass repetitively and buddies of mine can, and he's just never turned back up on the winter range. So,
oh man.
But yeah, so that's just part of hunting. And I definitely think that, I'm not the draw blood ethics police. You know, I think that once hunters have done their due diligence, I think they have maybe you can X this out of the podcast if you don't want me saying it. But I feel that if you've done your due diligence, and that's going to be different for every person, that you've got a right to get back in the saddle and start hunting again. I'm not saying that you do that time and time again. You know, if that happens a second time, you probably should be done. But, you know, I, shit happens bow hunting, and I'm just not the type that if you put in your due diligence that you can't get back in the saddle. For me, I hit that buck at the end of the hunt. I wasn't gonna hunt anything else at that point. But if that would have happened a month earlier, would I've gotten back in the saddle? Yeah, I'd like to think I would. And I just don't think that that draw blood, shit happens. And I don't think, and the game and fish departments, they take that stuff into account. Now, and again, if you've wounded two bucks, yeah, then I'd start. But yeah, what's your thought on that? I'd be curious what you think.
No, I'm in complete agreement with you on it. And like, and the way I look at it is like, and when, like you said, putting your due diligence in, is that's not just like, okay, I lost blood, I'm done, you know, like sort of deal. I'm talking like, you know, so I showed it in that elk film that when this comes out, it'll just, the film would have just came out where that bull, I got in 18 yards, I hit him and I nicked a branch, went right into his back strap on film. Mm-hmm. And, I looked for him, knowing that it probably wasn't lethal, but I was like, never know. So I just, you know, did my due diligence, ended up finding him again, and he was alive and fine. But even, you know, if it wasn't that case, after putting in all my effort to do everything I can to find that bull, buck, whatever it is, I would still hunt. That's the way I look at it. I know some people don't agree with that, but that's the way I look at it, because shit does happen. And, you know, it's like, I know I'm going to get absolutely railed as far as from people when they see a video. It's like, oh, you know, because I'd missed a bull earlier in the hunt and then, you know, wounded. And it's like, I own that, like, completely understand. You know, that's on me. But that happens, and it does happen to bow hunters. And it's like, okay, what can you do to improve on it? And I think it's also important to show that things can happen poorly sometimes, and analyze that situation. Don't beat yourself up to the point where you never bow hunt again, but like figure it out and work towards it, move towards it.
Yeah. And so that's the thing that I was kind of trying to highlight with this, this passing idea. I hit a buck, 175 inch 3x4 behind the shoulder, broadside, and I didn't get him. How does that even happen? Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's just so much crap that can happen. It just wouldn't be fair if you were penalized for something that was completely out of your control. I made a perfect shot. It just was a very bad circumstance where the deer was probably reacting to the sound of my bow or my arrow, and that front shoulder was coming back as my arrow was entering, and it is what it is. So that's the whole, like, my buddies and I make fun of guys that were just like, oh, I passed on that buck. And they'll even show like footage, like they'll show footage and they'll show like a deer or elk behind like this giant bush. And like, oh, I passed on it. Like, yeah, you passed on it. You're within 40 yards. Sure. But you're never going to get a shot opportunity in that stuff. Like, and then even if you do get an arrow off, I've had like, God, I had this whole room down here. I've got three spots upstairs for mounts in our living room, and then everything else gets crowded down here. And every few years I have to start cutting antlers off and sell them. Cause I, this is the spot I got, and it fills up, and keep the good ones. And anyway, but if passing on bucks meant killing bucks, this room would be full of giants. So,
yeah, I laugh at that too. Like, cause it's, you know, I do think sometimes people call passing anytime they see a deer too. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, passed on them. You know, it's like, yeah, that's all. Yeah.
I chose not to stalk, but to insinuate that, oh, that buck was dead to rights. That buck last year was more dead to rights than I could ever even possibly imagine, with that shot placement, the distance, like the setup. And I have no grip and grin. Like,
yeah,
what it is.
Well, there's a situation last year when I was in West Virginia that when I was telling you I was down there for those 4 days, the last day I, so where I hunt in this coal mine country, so you can actually spot and stalk almost like you would be with mule deer. And it was during the rut and I found this buck and I was and looking at it and, you know, for me, I'd been super happy with it, but we were really trying. It's a bow hunting only area. It's like these bucks can get really big. And we made the decision that we were hunting this spot that, you know, weren't going to shoot anything unless he was 150 inches or bigger. And that's that for a guy from Pennsylvania, that was like unheard of, you know, and this buck. And I'm like, he's probably about 145 inches, a 4 year old. And I'm like, you know, trying to, I'm like looking at him so much, you know, zooming in, you know, I had my phone scope on there and I'm like zooming in on him, like trying to make him bigger than he was. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to get a closer look. So, you know, I put a stalk in, he was bed down with a doe and, you know, I got within like 50 or 60 yards of him. And it's like, I'd be careful how I tell that story. It's not like I passed on this deer because a lot can happen with that closing the distance and the shot and all that stuff. But I chose not to go any further and, you know, backed off of it, you know. But that's such a good point because the term passing on it is like, how is that interpreted?
Well, and it's just a lot of times it's insinuated that oh, I could have killed that deer if I wanted to. Oh, I could have done. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I don't know if it's insecurity in eating tag soup or
a conversation point kind of keeping up with a story. Like, you know, someone says like, oh, I shot this. Well, yeah, I passed on one. You know, it's just like
an ego thing. I think that's really funny. I get a kick out of the. I get a kick out of that stuff. The one thing that I respect at it, you guys in the kind of some of those unorthodox methods out in the East. I know Tony does, you know, kind of spot and stalk with decoys on whitetails and stuff. And you were just talking about spot and stalk, in West Virginia. I got to imagine that, you know, the perception here in the West is that whitetails are pretty jumpy. So I got to imagine that, although the terrain may not be quite as difficult, but the alertness and awareness of the deer is probably on a next level over mule deer. Would you agree to that?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't hunted mule deer enough to really give a good, understanding of that, but whitetails are definitely jumpy and in that sort of way, and they can get boogered up, you know, pretty easily. But you know, it's funny you say that about the terrain though, because and where I hunt in West Virginia is I'll show you pictures of it. It's as steep as anywhere I've hunted out west. It's just not as tall. You know, there's like, you know, 1200 foot of elevation gain from top to bottom versus thousands of feet, you know, sort of deal.
Yeah.
And so it has some tougher terrain, but for the most part, it's, you know, definitely lacks terrain compared to hunting the Rocky Mountains, and you're not dealing with elevation or altitude and all that, you know, different kind of stuff there. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I'll be interested when I hunt some mule deer just a little bit more and just kind of see their mannerisms compared to whitetails and if it's similar or not, but I can't really speak on that specifically.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's just my perception. I've not hunted whitetails very much. But from what I've seen, they do seem quite, that being said, mule deer in general, it's kind of funny because here on the Wasatch, our deer see a lot of human pressure and, they are extremely jumpy. They're just so pressured. They've been hunted. They've been stalked so many times. They see a lot of humans. Compared to like where I hunt in Colorado, you can get away with so much. I'm not saying that Colorado guys have it easy, but what I can get away with in Utah versus what I can get away with in Colorado is night and day. And I was actually just talking to Brody, my good friend at Western Hunter, about this, that here on the front, literally I've got like, so I wake up when I scout about 3:30 to 3:45 in the morning, and I go up and I'll gain 3,000, you know, 2,000 to 3,000, maybe sometimes depending on where I'm at, up to 4,000 feet of elevation. For that, I have to get up a little earlier, and it'll be for like literally like the first 40 minutes of light, and then it's back down to work. And the crazy thing is how fast bucks will bed here on the front in the middle of the summer. And I go to Colorado on the muzzleloader hunt, and they've been bow hunted, and they still feed out till 10 in the morning. And I'm just like, oh my
God. Yeah.
It's just crazy. Like it's just crazy. And then some stuff that I've gotten away with. I mean, we've killed a number of bucks, bucks and bulls, on this muzzleloader hunt that we've been doing in Colorado. And half of them have been within bow range that would have been, you know, barring some, you know, it's a slower trajectory, barring anything like that, the animals could have been killed with an yep. arrow just based on the distance. And, it's just crazy the difference you can get away with, there. And this is an extremely remote area. We're packed in on horses or llamas, a stupid number of miles, you know, 15 to 22 miles.
Yeah. Anyway.
So I really wonder if the whitetails kind of behave more like, just in general, behave more like the deer that I'm used to on the Wasatch Front than, say, you know,
anyway. No, and I think that's also like different areas. Like I've never been to Texas hunting, but I've heard that the deer there, because everyone's always hunting them over feeders, that like you go to shoot, and if you're over, you know, 20, 30 yards, sometimes they can drop like a foot and a half, you know, by the time your arrow yeah. gets there, where we're not dealing with that, at least, you know, where I yeah. hunt typically. But, you know, they can be a little bit more skittish or looking up, especially if they know where tree stands are, or they've been hunted, you know, they start doing yeah. some of that kind of stuff, which is wild, but it's very situational.
You have deer that have been educated to stand so that they will look
yeah.
up. Looking for human beings in yeah. trees.
Yeah. Really? Especially if they've been spooked out of it. Like especially if they've been spooked out of it. I think it's like, I know, especially like in farm country and stuff, if they're coming out in certain spots and fields or whatever, and someone's got a ladder stand there that they're always in. I learned that when I was hunting, when I was in college, and I was hunting a bunch of ag ground, and it would be like, you'd hunt these same spots. But I remember looking across this field, and this doe came out and had looked in this corner where their guy had a tree stand, like looked up before, you know, she came out into the field. And it was just like that. It's mostly the does. It's mostly the does. They're smarter than the bucks, in my opinion, for like a lot of the times, like, cause the bucks, what the bucks will do is like send the does out first. So if they get out and they get out unscathed, then they can kind of follow along, especially if they're going to yeah. feed. But it's funny.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy. I didn't realize that. It's funny how you play off of different, you know, different things like that in different seasons. You know, obviously hunting the rut, you're hunting the does. And everyone thinks that the rut is just this magnificent time to hunt. And it is, because it brings the big dogs out. But man, it's so frustrating when they get all piled in together. And they're just way less predictable. But those does do bring the big bucks out. It's just another animal. You got to learn, and you got to grow, and you got to move with it. The biggest thing for me that I've noticed, just changing your tactic for the situation, is especially if you're still hunting mountains during the rut, I think that's a little different. But if they've come down into the foothills and you've got more of a prevailing, so in the mountains, you don't have prevailing winds so much as thermals. You know, if there's a major storm coming in, you may have a prevailing wind, but you're getting down to like flat country or rolling hills, you generally just have a prevailing wind. And I learned a handful of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, how much better I was doing hunting them, how I dog elk, but deer in the rut. And I I've just been so much more successful with that tactic than anything else. And it makes sense. Right.
Yeah.
And it's been productive for me.
No. And it's cool just to learn, you know, what works for you and then like adapting to the situations. You know, the way I hunt whitetails early on in the season is so much different than I hunt them during the rut, and then so much different than I hunt them during gun season and then late season. Yep. You know, like there's just, it's completely different. You know, you're still hunting the same animal, but there's different things that are going on and different tactics to be able to do that. And I don't know, I like getting creative with it. Like that's where I've had so much fun in West Virginia, because it was like a combination out west. You know, I'm doing some spot and stalk, or you know, hunting from the ground and doing just different things that are, you know, fun to be able to play around with and see what, you know, doing whatever it takes to figure out how to kill some of these deer.
Yeah, thinking outside of the box. Yeah, definitely. And if you want to keep drawing tags, and yeah, you may not be able to get those quintessential high country mule deer hunts every year, but you can get tags every year that are a little less quality and maybe require different tactics. And
yeah,
if you grind on those and you do them enough, then you'll start figuring things out. And
yeah.
Yep.
Well, cool. I love it, man. I mean, I apologize for taking 2 hours of your time out here, but I was having fun with that conversation.
Yeah, no, I actually, I guess I see the timer up there in the corner. I didn't even realize it was 4 hours. So
yeah, it goes
by quick when you just start bullshitting.
I know. No, that was a really fun conversation, James. I mean, I appreciate you coming on and talking to me. As like I said, it was funny. You know, we just, you know, met in person for the first time a few days ago, and I was like, love to have you on the podcast, and it worked out like right away to be able to get the schedules lined up and, you know, to be able to do that. So thank you. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity, and yeah. It's nice getting to meet you. Just getting to chat. I had a lot of fun on this discussion, and really hoping you, I love deer. Like I've got to kill it. Like my wife will literally tell me that if it gets later into the season, I haven't killed an elk, my wife will gently remind me that the elk is table fare and the deer is just jerky or whatever. And so I'll get gently reminded that if I haven't killed an elk, I need to fill the freezer. But I'm really excited that you're going to pursue the king of the West, which I view as mule deer. But that's only recently, I'd say in the last six years or so, changed for me. Because before that, for a period there, man, I just thought that elk were, and I still love elk. I love to eat elk. I love hunting elk in the rut. I love elk too. But man, something about the places that mule deer take you, and they're just, it's like this chess match with a big buck. And it's this competition with a very intelligent animal that's weary, or wary, and their instincts are so intense. I've literally had three deer now on the Wasatch Front that are basically just flat disappeared. The one KK that appeared in the rut, right? I mean, if it wasn't for trail cameras, literally all my trail cameras did, because he never hit, like, I had like two trail cameras that he hit more than one time, but like, I ran 30 different trail camera spots. I had like 20 cameras that I circulated between 30 spots. And in that number, he only hit two twice. So it was just unpatternable. So that deer, basically, I saw him with my own eyes years prior when he was younger. But that year that I killed him, I saw him like July 8th. And then I didn't see him again with my own eyes until November 18th, like 15th. 12th. I can't remember the exact date, but something like that. And then there's a buck that I called Quad Pod that a guy named Connor Rollins killed. That buck flat disappeared until the rut. Same thing, was visible all summer long. I know of, you know, plenty of heavy hitters on the Wasatch Front. Myself, Ty Glenn, Sean Morgan. I know Connor was after the buck. lots of us were after this buck that year, and he vanished and ghosted everybody until the rut brought him out. No, literally nobody saw him in between those dates. And then a buck that I was personally chasing last year did the same thing after opening day, got a little bit of pressure and disappeared. And it's just crazy that they can do that, that their instincts drive them to do that. And if you're hunting an animal that is that instinctual, that his habits force him to essentially, his habits make him be so reclusive. It's just matching wits with, I don't know, I think it's just like the ultimate chase game, matching wits with a deer with an animal that can be that reclusive. I mean, evade that many hunters, evade trail cameras, they're just incredible animals. And that, so I'm really excited that you're going to kind of focus on mule deer, and wish you the best in South Dakota, and try to use some of those. Obviously, I think in South Dakota, it's fairly open terrain, so you'll probably be able to spot and stalk. You're not going to, if you do, oh, you mentioned you probably won't go back for the rut, but I like to tell a lot of people that in that rolling hill country, like I said, don't be afraid to hunt them more like elk at that point. Not calling, not so much calling, but just kind of dog in the herd type mentality.
No, that makes total sense. I have such a problem doing anything else in November other than hunting whitetails during the rut that it's just,
that's
my thing. I am hunting Sitka blacktail deer October 29th and November 4th this year in Alaska. So like that's like one of those things where it's like, I've been wanting to do it forever, but I've hated that it takes away from my favorite time to whitetail hunt. Yeah. But, I can't complain about that at all, 'cause it'll be amazing.
No.
So,
and I'm the opposite. Like if I've not killed a deer on the front, a lot of people have asked me if I've ever been interested in going to go whitetail hunting. And honestly, I would. I was talking to John Barklow about this in kind of when we were all kind of just there having fun shooting the shit. A few years ago, 5 years ago now, I ended a hunt on a really shitty Arizona elk tag, but I'd never killed a bull in Arizona. And it was the last state I needed to kill, except for Nevada. Nevada hates me and they only have draw tags for elk. But I've killed a bull in every state surrounding Utah, including Utah, but Nevada. And I needed to kill a bull in Arizona. So I put in for a crappy, pretty much draw it if you put in for it, a tag. It's basically just cedar country, lots of trees. Anyway, the name of the game is sitting water and just hope that you get lucky. It was back when you could still use trail cameras in Arizona, so I placed a lot of trail cameras. And for 2 weeks, it was a two-week hunt over Thanksgiving. So my friend Jaron drove down with me and helped me set like 15 trail cameras. And then I drove him to the airport and he came home. And then I was like the next 12 days solo. I did break for Thanksgiving, went to my in-laws' house, came back, but basically for 12 days, I was solo sitting water, and I killed, I killed a small 5-point the last 10 minutes of legal shooting light of the last day. And wasn't a big bull, but a couple of things. That bull did a lot for me. It secured that basically this desire of killing a bull in every state touching Utah. And then I killed 3 bulls with my bow that year in 3 different states, all general tag, pretty much general tag. That was a draw tag, but if you put in for it, you draw it. So that bull, he wasn't giant, but man, that bull meant a lot because it just accomplished a lot of goals for me. 3 bulls in 3 states with a bow is something I've done 2. I'd never done that. So I really wanted to do that. Now I've got my eye set on killing like 3 nice 6-points in 3 states, but I've not yet to accomplish that one.
Yeah, that's
the freaking animals like Corey Jacobson and doesn't get mentioned a lot, but man, a guy that I just idolize is Nate Simmons. That guy does the Western Hunter TV. I don't know I mean, there's been multiple seasons where that guy will kill three bulls in granted, it's his job, right? So again, going back to that comparison thing, you know, he's doing that for a living, but holy hell, three mature 6 points in three states and filling in, you know, some archery deer hunts as well.
Oh, yeah.
That's, yeah. So I'd really love to do that. And I'm not tied to the archery only, on that. Like I said, I've had my butt kicked so much on rifle hunts that
yeah, you'd rather you know, archery hunt at that point.
Yeah, just, yeah, exactly. Like give me the rut and yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I've got, trying to do it this year. I got three elk tags, two archery and, two archery and one muzzleloader. So try to see if we can do that this year. I don't know if it's a goal, but it's always like in the back of my mind, man, if I could do this, that would be awesome. But I don't know. Probably won't happen.
Well, no, but, man, I wish you luck with else? That. That's, I mean, that sounds like it's exciting. I mean, they even have three elk tags now with like trying to get tags is not simple to be able to do. And, you know.
Yeah. So Idaho, you can always do that. The OTC option there. Utah has really shitty OTC tags, probably the worst OTC tag in the country, but it's a tag. And fortunately I'm here, so I can learn it a little bit more than, you know, you can play your cards right in Colorado and pick up a tag pretty easy. They're there. There's opportunities there. They're just not highly desirable tags and they just take time. And fortunately for me in Utah, time's on my side with my job that I can hunt in the mornings. But I was going to ask you, what else? So you said you had South Dakota, the Sitka Blacktail. Do you got an elk hunt lined up this year? Or?
So I did. I drew a Idaho elk tag. It was over the counter, but I got in, but I ended up turning that tag back in. So I'm actually going to Alaska to hunt moose in September, which is an absolute dream.
You mentioned that.
So I'm getting dropped off and just a DIY hunt, lake hunt, getting dropped off. And I'm going to spend the whole season in there with a good buddy of mine and my camera guy, Justin, to just, yeah, go for it, man. So I'm taking a rifle taking a bow.
Okay. So how does that work? Is that like do you just buy a moose tag or did you have to draw it?
No, you just buy a moose tag. The hardest part is getting a transporter to fly in because they're so backed up. And I got lucky that the guy I'm going with, Ethan, he had flown with this transporter in like 2018 and they only take repeat clients because they're so booked up. And so he got in and invited me. So I got to go as a, you know, plus one essentially to be able to go do that hunt.
So you can just go buy a moose tag as long as you have a transporter. So that's a fairly economical hunt. I mean, that you're not paying you got the transport fee, but you're not paying outfitter fees. You haven't waited years to draw that tag. That's rad. I've heard of a lot of people doing that with caribou. Yeah. And that's been something that I really wanted to do. I didn't know that there was such a thing as doing that for moose.
So. Yeah, it's the hardest part is getting in with the transporter because they're always so backed up. So it's almost like drawing a tag from that standpoint and to be able to do it. But I did the caribou hunt in 2020 and I was like, man, I need to go back to Alaska. It's so amazing. So I've been, you know, working at it and I wasn't planning on doing two hunts there this year. I had the blacktail hunt booked. It's same thing. It's like I have a charter, so I'll be on a boat, but they just drop you off every day and you come back and sleep on the boat. And had that booked for a couple of years and the moose hunt came up and I was like, holy crap, how am I gonna make this work? But I was like, I'm gonna figure it out because I've always wanted to do that. So yeah, I got so the moose hunt and then the South Dakota deer and then I go back to Kodiak there. So it's and then whitetail sprinkled in between there, but
yeah,
which has me worried because I got you know all that time I'm going to be and I'm not complaining for anybody listening, believe me. But as all this time I'm going to be spending everywhere else, it's like for me to kill a good whitetail in Pennsylvania, I need to like it's like with you at the front. It's like I need to put a lot of time in. Like that's it gives me stressed out. It's like all right, I got to figure out how I'm going to do that. So,
Yeah. I know that feeling all too well. I try not to spread myself too thin, and pretty much every year I do, but, I'm probably only going to make one trip out to Colorado this year. So I got a deer and elk tag. So probably going to go for 12 days and just call it good after that. So try to combo hunt that. We'll make probably three trips up to Idaho, two different early trips for elk, and then rifle deer. They're in different units, so those couldn't even overlap. And then Utah, I just sprinkle those in. Obviously, focused here on early September. Deer hunting sucks here. And then focus out of state. October, kind of hunt some elk. Deer can actually start to be good again in October on the front where it's archery only. And then obviously November, it's dedicated to deer. Like you were saying with whitetail, like you can't think of, if I haven't killed a deer early, oh, I could not imagine hunting anything else but deer on the front in November if I hadn't already filled my tag. And that's the beauty of the Arizona hunt is you can tack that one on in January after Christmas and your wife loves you again, so she'll let you go.
Get her something nice for Christmas, and it's like, all right.
Yeah, get her something nice for Christmas. Yeah, this year we're going to Hawaii. I've never been to Hawaii, but I've heard it's great, and my wife loves it. So we're going to Hawaii in February. Yeah. So I'm hoping that between a good Christmas and a trip to Hawaii that I should be golden for that Jan, because it's always dicey. By the end of November, it's like I can sense that the animosity a little bit. And then we have a nice December and then I'm like, hey, so there's this January hunt. Oh, that hunt that you do every year in January. Oh yeah, that one. So what do you think?
And she's like, yeah, I know you're going to do it. So
yeah. Well, this year when Jaron and I did it, so I've done that four or five times. One time I went down, they actually came down. We were staying with in-laws in the central region of Arizona. And we got down there, just got to the in-laws house where my wife's parents live in Sholo. And then I was going to turn around and leave. But like we all started not feeling very good. And I was like, oh, maybe we ate something. Anyway, it turned into like this gnarly flu. So for a week, I tried to go and came back and I was just like barfing. And so for like 8 days, we just lived in our in-laws house, which is not a very big house. And we just like were sick. So that sucked. Then another time I killed a 3x3 down there, not near as nice as this one. Kind of the same, visiting the in-laws. And then Jaron and I went down in 2022 where I killed that guy right there, I guess my camera. And that was like a Rocky Mountain type hunt where it was like, we're leaving Thursday night and we're coming back the following Sunday. Like this is a bunch of time dedicated, no in-laws. And so that was a treat. And then this last year it was 5 days, kind of like an extended weekend type thing. Fly down. It was literally like fly down after work one night, get there at 11. Brody picks me up, hit the grocery store to pick up some water, a little bit of food. We're hunting, glassing that next morning, hunt 5 days, and then take the first flight back to Salt Lake after the 5 days. And I really liked how that was because it's normally like a 15-hour drive to get. I mean, we're really far south, so that's really fun. That hunt is fun. It's so hard though because there's days that you don't see a deer, and when you get multiple days like that, it's tough. It's tough to stay motivated, especially on the front. I can do it because I know what I'm going after because I scouted them. In Arizona, when you go 2 or 3 days and you haven't seen a deer, you start questioning like, why the hell am I hunting like this deep desert? I could go up in the foothills and see a lot of deer. Bucks aren't going to be as big, but just give and take, right?
100%. Well, cool, James. I want you to tell everybody before we go here just where people can find some of your stuff. I know you have a really cool bow build video series that you did for Western Hunter. It's on their YouTube, I believe.
Oh yeah.
Is that? I might have just told everybody where it's at, but
yeah. Yeah, I actually appreciate you saying that because I wanted to say this, and maybe it was bad to say this at the 2-hour and 18-minute mark because maybe people aren't going to make through this. But yeah, so right now we're running a big bow giveaway on our Western Hunter platform. So I went down and set up Brody's bow, but it was kind of more from an educational standpoint. And we made videos about how I set up bow. I've written a ton about it, but this time we wanted to do a video format. So we have 4 really in-depth archery videos on the Western Hunter YouTube. And to help get word out about this, we partnered with Hoyt, Hamsky, Spot Hog, Easton, Iron Will. We've got like the $6,000 my ideal archery setup. It's a Hoyt carbon bow, just top of the line everything. And so that's the giveaway. It's free. You have to enter your email and you got to follow me and Western Hunter, but criteria is pretty easy. I'm Yates_in_the_backcountry on Instagram or Western Hunter magazine. You can see the giveaway there. There's a landing page. It's got a link to the YouTube videos. They're really in depth. They're highly educational. So if you've ever thought about setting up a bow yourself, or you're looking for tuning tips and tricks or peep tie-in, that sort of thing, it's all there. It's the type of video that I think, you know, there's people like John Dudley who does a lot of this stuff, but I don't think he quite goes into the detail that I go into here. And then, you know, bow shops don't want to go into that detail because that's their business, right? So I think that's, it's in a position where I just don't think there's much out there like it. It's this comprehensive building a bow from the ground up, extremely detailed, maybe overly detailed. There's probably 3.5 hours in the 4 videos. But the Ultimate Archery giveaway with it, we'll probably run that through most of August, I would think. When do you think you'll post the podcast?
Yeah, it'll probably be middle of August.
Okay. Yep. So, yeah, so that'll be running still probably at that time. And then the videos are obviously on YouTube and they'll be there forever. I write for Western Hunter, the archery column. So pretty much every issue I've got something archery related in there. A lot of preparation stuff, hunting tactics. And then I'm fairly active on Instagram in posting content. I am really busy, so I'm not always the most prompt at getting back on DMs. I do eventually work through them. But I do try to put a lot of content on bow related content on Instagram.
Yeah. So definitely recommend checking those out. And on the week before this, Eric Jackson would have been on the podcast, and he talked about this, the video series there too. So you can find it. And, you've helped out a lot of people through the writing I haven't watched the bow build series yet, but from what I've heard, very informative. And, you know, as Eric said, he's like, get yourself a beer or whiskey and, you know, just go through it and just, you know, take it all in. But
yeah, they're long, but they're in depth. They're everything you need to know. It's a resource that if I had right when I first decided I was done with shops, man, it would have saved a lot of heartache. So that's what I'm trying to do. Help guys get up the learning curve so they don't get stuck in the proverbial rut so that they can, yep, just plow through it and do it on your own and do it to the best of your ability. And I think everyone should have a moderate understanding of how to tune their bow, honestly, because you go to a shop, and they can only take you so far. It's not them shooting the bow, right? Like your paper tune will change. Your bare shaft tune will change. Your third axis changes depending on how you grip the bow. So especially if you're even thinking about putting a fixed blade broadhead on your arrow, you got to know some basic tuning.
Yep. No, most definitely. Well, cool. So. All right, buddy. Well, thank you again for coming on. Yeah. And I think what we'll do with this, anyone that's listening, I think I'm going to split this one into two episodes, two parts, and break it down. We did a lot of archery, you know, related stuff at the beginning, and then mule deer kind of towards the end, segment it just to make it easier. I know for me, like when they're like, and I've been breaking them up recently, whenever they go about 2 hours long, I always break them up into two parts, and then they're a little bit easier to digest, especially with information heavy stuff. So check out both of these episodes here and all the stuff James, you know, talked about here. But yeah, man, thank you so much.
Yeah, Bo, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you, and like love what you're doing, and your intention just seems so pure, like trying to help guys. Wow, I trying to help guys, because like I've had so much shit hit the fan, so a lot of my stuff just helps guys prepare, and I feel like you're genuinely trying to help guys do what you've done, what you love, go from east to west, and you know you're just generally trying to help. So I relate to that, and I say props to you and great work.
No, I appreciate that, because that's exactly it. I've been in everyone's shoes, and I'm trying to, you know, continue to improve myself. So it's just as much selfish wanting to learn as, you know, wanting to help people. But I figured if they can happen at the same time, that's good.
Yeah. Here eventually, if I decide to ever give up in November, maybe I'll start pinging you with questions about hunting whitetails in November.
So. Sounds good, man.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.